From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a new pope and dueling budgets on Capitol Hill. A puff of white smoke at the Vatican, and then Pope Francis out of Argentina. "Pray for me," he said from the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica.
Pregate per me. E a presto, ci vediamo presto.
In Washington, dueling budgets and deja vu, Paul Ryan back with a Republican plan to cut spending, remake entitlements, and, he said, balance the budget in 10 years.
This is our offer. This is our vision. And what you do is you actually show the country what you believe in.
Democrats with their own plan. President Obama told ABC News growth and jobs are his top priority.
My goal is not to chase a balanced budget just for the sake of balance. My goal is how do we grow the economy, put people back to work.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Amy Walter from the Cook Political Report, Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining us from Washington today, Amy Walter, national editor at the Cook Political Report. Amy, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
With us from NBC News, Kelly O'Donnell. Kelly, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be with you.
And Jack Beatty, from joining us from wonderful New Hampshire. Jack, good to have you right there.
Hello, hello, Tom, Amy, and Kelly.
Can we go straight to Rob Portman, Ohio Republican senator, and coming out just in the last day, I guess, to say, after earlier opposition, he will now support gay marriage. This after learning and coming to the public with the fact that his own son is gay. Here he is talking with CNN. This was just yesterday.
I've come to the conclusion that for me personally, I think this is something that we should allow people to do, to get married and to have the joy and the stability of marriage that I've had for over 26 years. I want all three of my kids to have it, including our son, who is gay.
Rob Portman, Republican senator from Ohio. Kelly O'Donnell, who wouldn't want, a good life for their own child, their own son? Rob Portman's really an interesting case. His name was on the short list as a potential vice presidential candidate to Mitt Romney. There's been controversy in this very quarter around him before. What do you make of this timing and him coming out with this now, Kelly?
Well, I've had the opportunity to cover and get to know Rob Portman and his family for a while, and he does indicate that Mitt Romney knew about this, so he had disclosed it in the vetting process during the VP search. We understand it had nothing to do with the ultimate decision. What I'm struck by is this is a very personal story for Rob Portman, his own sort of journey at looking at this issue from being someone who had originally voted for the Defense of Marriage Act, being more typically a part of the Republican Party's view that marriage should be between one man and one woman, and his own journey here of seeing through his son the importance of what marriage as an institution can mean. What I was struck by is how he says this is not a challenge to traditional marriage. It's actually a tribute to it because of the desire for people to have a long-term stable relationship that is acknowledged by the state. He, of course, says this shouldn't affect what religious entities decide to do. But he has come through this process with his family, and I think it will be a very interesting moment because Rob Portman is well thought of by many people. I think in Ohio, of course, you also have Sherrod Brown, who's a Democratic, mm-hmm. very progressive senator, who is also for gay marriage. In a state where that issue has been one of the more heated, volatile issues on the ballot. So I think Rob Portman will get a lot of attention. I think he is going through a personal issue here because this is his son. Mm-hmm. So the journey is personal. And I think there is a certain amount of political courage when you talk about the Republican Party now. And it'll be interesting to see if others will follow his lead, if this is one of those moments where people's views are changing because of personal connections. And that's one of the most powerful ways that political views can change.
It sure is. Just ask Dick Cheney. And apparently he did, Amy Walter. I mean, in reading that, he called Dick Cheney, who's, of course, whose daughter is gay, to talk about how to handle this. Do we know, Amy, whether the Rob Portman's son's sexuality came into play in Mitt Romney's choice of a vice presidential candidate? Was this known back then? Did it come into the equation?
Well, as Kelly noted, the head of the vetting for Mitt Romney's campaign has told reporters who've asked her about this today, including one from NBC, that yes, they knew about this. Yes, he was forthcoming with it when they were vetting him. And no, it had absolutely no impact on who Mitt Romney ultimately chose for his nominee. And to the broader point, I think this is a really good question, which is, does the personal now become political? I think that Rob Portman has opened an opportunity here for Republicans to think about new ways of talking about this issue. Listen, it's pretty clear that when you talk to voters under the age of 30 or 40, this is a no-brainer. Whether they're Republican or Independent or Democrat, it is almost universal in terms of their support for some form of union, gay marriage for gay couples. So the question for Republicans is not a matter of if, but when they were going to be getting on this demographic train that's already left the station. And the way that Rob Portman has provided this opportunity is by saying, let's stop calling this a liberal issue. Let's start celebrating the fact that we have couples that are embracing a conservative idea, which is raising families. And we are the family, you know, again, if you're gonna look at this as a marketing opportunity, we're the family party. We're for strong families and policies that support those families. Let's bring them all in.
I mean, that's a logic people can follow. But my, oh, my, is that the evolution of an idea within the Republican framing of this? Jack, I want to come to you on this, but we've got callers right away. Karen in Des Moines, Iowa. Karen, you're on.
Yes, I think much of this has just been said, but I just have thought about this for many, many years, that if we have to wait for every legislator of every party to have a personal experience with an issue.
Someone in their own family, you're saying.
Somebody in your own family or your best friend or whatever. If we have to wait for all of these people to, this will sound harsh, but have a loved one get raped, have them get AIDS, come out of the closet, get shot in a theater or a school, what is it about us as a human family that we cannot understand that just because it doesn't happen to us doesn't mean it doesn't happen to someone, and we could think about it in a bigger frame of mind? I mean, maybe Rob Portman should know someone who's poor or who doesn't have a job. And maybe that would change it.
And right on down the list, are we that empathy challenged? Well, I mean, maybe we are, but it's a great point, Karen. Jack Beatty, here we are, Rob Portman doing this as CPAC, the big conservative meeting, is holding its gathering in Washington and thinking about the party's future. As Amy says, here's a little catching up with the demographic train right away. Younger Americans, not so concerned about gay marriage. Now Rob Portman on board there. But what a big picture as Republicans, as conservatives meet, and you hear Karen's complaint from Des Moines. Does it have to be personal before we can see the problem, the issue?
Yes, what a comment on moral imagination. Mm-hmm. It certainly has to transcend personal experience and be bigger than all that. Senator Portman's statement, you mentioned evolution, comes in a week when President Clinton editorialized against the Defense of Marriage Act, said the court should strike it down, and of course he signed it. That just shows how far we've come. And in fact, with Senator Portman, his evolution has been even more rapid. As recently as June, he told one source that he opposed the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, which would allow businesses to fire gay people without fear of legal action. So he's come a long way in a short period.
We've got CPAC meeting in Washington, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who's been making waves and getting a lot of attention lately, calling there for a party, the Republican Party, that stands on broad, appealing principles and at the same time criticizing elements of his own party, the GOP, on the first day of CPAC. Here's Rand Paul.
We are the party of jobs and opportunity. The GOP is the ticket to the middle class. The GOP of old has grown stale and moss-covered. Now, I don't think we need to name any names, do we?
Stale and moss-covered. I don't know if that's hot language, but it's certainly drawing lines, Kelly. What about the CPAC meeting and what's emerging there in terms of how this party is understanding itself and where it may be headed?
Well, they're certainly trying to find some identity. And I think what we're seeing with Rand Paul is that feisty spirit that propelled him to a 13-hour filibuster that really touched a a sense among many conservatives that he is now someone who is willing to take on these fights and go up against the establishment. I watched that filibuster when it was happening and at
on drones.
Mm-hmm. And he does take on larger issues. Mm-hmm. And when you have some of the establishment in the party who were rushing at nearly midnight to support him, it was a sign that conservatives were really tapping into this. I think that for Rand Paul, he will continue to be someone who will sort of get under the nerves of some of the establishment. I think that's a lane he's comfortable in, with issues that he feels are principled. And at CPAC, there is somewhat of an identity crisis in trying to find out, is it a traditional Republican model that just needs new branding, or is it kind of taking a slightly different approach and having more of a kind of an electric quality to it, which the Jim DeMintz and the Rand Pauls are trying to encourage. So it is a group that has been trying to find a way to be relevant and to reach out and to, I think, remind itself of how important it is. That sometimes comes into play. You've got Paul Ryan, I believe, is speaking right as we are talking, and some of the other key names. And of course, there's been so much attention about who was not included, which can become a badge of honor in some respects, too.
Chris Christie, not invited, not this time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news here. Pope Francis, budget dance, a gun bill moves in the Senate. No big gulp ban in New York. And knives on the plane getting a lot of attention this week. Amy, help us understand what's happened this week in terms of the budget. Here's Paul Ryan back. Almost a sense of deja vu, as if it were a year or more ago, with him talking about budget ideas, plans, proposals. Democrats with their own version on the table here, though these are sort of broad proposals, not exactly proposed budgets, I guess. But what do we see in the two visions or more put forward this week, Amy? Is there movement on either side?
If you look at those two budgets, your first reaction should be, did we have an election in 2012?
Yeah.
Because it feels as if we are still back in 2009, 10, 11. But in many ways, they are reflective of the 2012 election, which was essentially a status quo election where both sides can say they won. House Republicans can say, look, we put up the Paul Ryan budget, and Democrats said that it was going to sink our party. We were going to lose the House. It was terrible, awful, no good, disastrous policy. And Republicans, though, of course, Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney lost their bid for the White House. They held on to the House. They only lost 8 seats, and they carried seniors. Even though Democrats were talking about and demagoguing the issue of Medicare, they won seniors by about 12 points. So they say, obviously, this is something that is still relevant. Democrats say, wait, we won the election. Mm. We picked up seats in the Senate. The White House was a big win. It wasn't just a narrow victory. It was a big win on the popular vote and electoral vote. And we won on an economic message that says we don't want these kinds of harsh cuts. We want to see the economy grow, and we want to invest more. We want to see more investment in infrastructure, and we want to see more revenues from either closing loopholes for wealthy people or raising taxes on wealthy people. And so this is where we're going to stand for a while. And quite frankly, both sides can continue to, quote unquote, win on these issues because of the fact that the House is so thanks to redistricting and other reasons, it's so settled that there are very few Republican incumbents that have to worry about losing the seat. It's a very, very long shot for Democrats to get that House back. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, if Republicans don't sort of catch up to where the demography is going, they're going to have a very hard time winning the White House. And so we sort of see a stalemate until one side or the other decides they're tired of losing one of those bodies or the other. And that's where you see movement.
So both parties, maybe they win in that sense. But I mean, right at the end of this month, we have another that's deadline right. coming up. Paul Ryan on Tuesday at his press conference trying to make a kind of a positive out of the fact that he's sticking with this in spite of the elections in November. Here's Ryan.
The election didn't go our way. Believe me, I know what that feels like. That means we surrender our principles. That means we stop believing in what we believe in. Look, whether the country intended it or not, we have divided government. we have the second largest House majority we've had since World War II.
So here's President Obama coming to Capitol Hill this week, talking with congressmen and women about where all this goes. Kelly O'Donnell, is there some kind of movement here? There were positive noises yesterday, Mitch McConnell and others saying, good to see the president. We're talking about interesting things. They've got their ideological positions here. Is there some sort of knitting toward a center here or not?
The outcome is yet to be determined, and I think it's still pretty much a long shot. But the moment we're in with these new conversations does seem to be well received on all sides. You have to remember, you have members of Congress who have worked with past presidents in many cases, who had relationships with those presidents of either party. And with President Obama, there was a genuine and repeated frustration about not having an opportunity. And it's not about going to the movies with the president or hanging out or having fun. It's about having a private meeting where for even just a few minutes, they could express their concerns, talk about issues, get a sense of the president's views without the attention, without the outside glare. A private meeting, building relationships. So being able to do that. And, of course, as you know, he met with Republicans and Democrats in both sides of the Capitol and has had some smaller meetings as well and more phone calls. So what I'm hearing from Republicans is that there is a greater degree of respect. They believe the president is very clearly signaling to them a willingness to work on entitlements if they will at the same time do some of these hard tax issues. They know that it's not easy for either party to deal with this. And there was a lot of concern among Republicans to try to encourage the president to help Democrats sort of go along. And among Democrats, there was a, as Nancy Pelosi said, a unity, but also at the same time, kind of an exchange of their own differing views, because there's a lot of concern among especially progressive Democrats about what might change with programs like Medicare or Social Security. So does the talking matter? I think it actually has real value. The question is, can they turn this moment of communication and maybe momentum into something where the real courage comes in, and that is committing to these issues publicly and taking what will be painful steps for both parties.
Here's Washington State Democratic Senator Patty Murray introducing that Democratic budget on the Senate floor on Wednesday, focusing on the economy. Raising taxes on the wealthy does not balance the budget.
By focusing on jobs and the economy, cutting spending responsibly, and calling on the wealthiest Americans to pay their fair share. The Senate budget, Mr. President, which we put out today, reflects the pro-growth, pro-middle-class agenda that the American people went to the polls and supported in November.
Paul Ryan in one corner, Patty Murray in another. Jack Beatty, do you see a chance with the talk of some little elements of amity this week, of a puff of white smoke on a budget agreement? On a budget agreement here.
Well, I thought I saw one last night watching Mitch McConnell, of all people, speak of the present meeting with the pre-called a, quote, a great meeting. That's Mitch McConnell. And this was seconded by no less than Ted Cruz, who also said it was a fine meeting with the president, this after their Senate Republican luncheon with Mr. Obama. And they especially praised the president's willingness to cut the corporate tax rate and to do it in a revenue-neutral way. And if I'm not mistaken, McConnell said the president volunteered revenue-neutral. And that really impressed them. And then the president went to the House Democrats, and they said, well, he was very, very optimistic about the economy, about the country, and about working something out. Well, who knows? But, you know, you can see some signs. I watched the markup of the Democratic budget before the Budget Committee last night. And Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, proposed a means testing for Medicare. A pretty bold idea. And it didn't get any Democratic votes, but a couple of Democratic senators looked at him and said, we're going to be with you when we talk about this in a large scale. We can't deal with this now, but we want to come back to this very thing. Well, that's, you know, you could say, well, that doesn't mean... That would be a tax increase, in effect, on affluent seniors. And there was Graham. There were Republicans voting for it.
Amy Walter, what about the issue of the balanced budget? Paul Ryan says he'll do it. Of course, the change in the calculation that the sequester has produced helps him do that. Democrats saying, we're just not worried about it. It's not our first priority. I've got a little taste of that from the White House here. And then I want to hear your thoughts about how this plays out. Here's Jay Carney. This is yesterday's White House press briefing, talking about the importance or lack thereof of balancing the federal budget.
Getting to zero at the end of your budget document even if you do it in a real way as opposed to a fanciful way, is not in and of itself good. It is only good if you do it in a way that's good for the economy, good for the American people.
So that's the argument that gets made, Amy, and we hear it. I'm looking at the Washington Post today, editorial pretty tough on the Democrats' complacent budget plan. What about this issue of balance or don't balance the federal budget, how it plays, how it works, or if it works?
Well, I'll leave it to the economists to debate how it works and what we need. And clearly, you know, there is a lot of discussion, and economists, one thing they do agree about is the fact that, you know, too much austerity can be very problematic, especially when you have an economy that is now, looks like we got the green shoots, they're starting to sprout. You don't want to do anything to damage those. At the same time, Democrats do have a messaging problem here, which is there are a whole lot of people out there in this country who do believe that the government spends too much. It is not a particularly politically smart thing to say that the government is efficient or could be spending more. So what Democrats have to do is to try to find a way to talk about balancing in a way that also acknowledges the fact that, you know, the real issue here is about growing the economy for everybody. Defending the importance of government is a very, very tough thing to do, even though in theory, almost everybody in this country receives some benefit from the government at a point in their lives. It's still a very, very tough argument to make. So this is where, when you listened to Patty Murray, the Senate budget chairman, talk about this, she was emphasizing things like growth, middle class. Those are the sorts of areas that the president succeeded on. And I think that's where you're going to hear Democrats spend a lot more of their time. But when it comes right down to it, more people believe that the deficit is a problem than it isn't. And Democrats have to meet voters where they are, which is concerned about these things, while also being able to make the case for why they want to see investment by the government in all kinds of different programs.
Jack, I want to come to you on maybe these conflicting desires of the American public here when it comes to balanced budget. Let's go to a caller here, Gustavo in Boston. Gustavo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It seems that every story is coming through a conservative frame. And when I listen to Kelly, I think I'm listening to a spokesperson for the moderate wing of the Republican Party, if it existed.
Why? Why do you say that? What do you mean?
Well, let me ask you guys what you think of the Congressional Progressive Caucus budget. And the correct answer can't be unrealistic, because that's not going to be acceptable, because the Ryan plan is equally unrealistic and gets rejected by the GOP on a regular basis.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people are saying when you get down to actual brass tacks, it won't be exactly that. The Progressive Caucus has got even more investment, more pushing for programs and jobs. But what's your point there, Gustavo?
Well, what concerns me is that we give all this time to the Ryan budget, which the Republicans reject. We give no time at all to the Congressional Progressive budget, which even Mark Zandi says, yes, this would work. And it's part of this crazy media focus where I go to the gym and all I see on TV is the CPAC conference, as if that matters. The Ryan budget gets scabs of air time and print time, as if it matters. And yet the Grijalva plan, no American even knows it exists. And you know what? I know why, because if Brian Williams was to talk about it on the news tonight, a lot of the watchers would actually like it.
Jack, I'm going to bring that to you. Gustavo, thank you for your call and your complaint, in a way. Let me take it to our panel.
Well, I would like to just say that I certainly reject his characterization. I respect his opinion. Part of why we talk about Paul Ryan is because he is the chairman of the Budget Committee, and Republicans happen to control the House right now, which is also
pretty
why
big
we
deal.
Focus. Yeah, that we have to deal with the rules as they exist, and they have the control in the House, just as we focus to a great extent on Patty Murray, who runs the Budget Committee in the Senate, and we're giving that quite a look. So by talking about what Republicans are saying with respect to the president is in part because that's where the biggest bridge needs to take place. If we're talking about Democrats and progressives and the president, we know that there's more connection there. So when we're talking about the developments, we tend to go between the two parties to try and see where is the daylight or where is the impasse. And so I reject his characterization of my views, but I certainly respect it.
Jack, what about the overall conversation we get in this country? The Progressive Caucus budget, you know, it's got a lot of infrastructure investment out there, keeps unemployment compensation strong. They're talking about allowing all the tax cuts to expire for families earning over $250K. Is that not getting a big enough workout? What about Gustavo's complaint about the balance and the way the news media even covers the debate over the debate over the debate about the budget?
Well, I think Kelly is right that in the foreground we do have Paul Ryan. He does have power. He does get coverage. On the other hand, I can't but agree with Gustavo. You have Paul Krugman today saying, you know, Nobel Prize winning economist, a liberal to be sure. He's saying, here's the real idea on the budget about the Progressive Caucus budget. And, you know, in general, things that come out of the Progressive Caucus are marginalized in advance by the media. You know, let's face it, people in the media, the last thing they want to seem is progressive or liberal.
Why?
So they're not going to volunteer. Well, because, of course, it's,
Obama,
you know,
won the White House. It's at least a split.
You know, that's the reality. And so, and also to start with, that makes it seem like it's beside the point. Well, wait a minute. So what? It's got no chance of winning. Why are we even talking about it? As Gustavo said, neither does the Ryan plan. But that's the way we are. And, you know, just over the years, we haven't heard about this caucus. For example, right now they're talking about a bill to have hedge funders pay the same rate of taxation as their secretaries. That's getting no ink. And the point is, I guess if these things did get some ink, Gustavo, I think makes a good point. If Brian Williams mentioned it, maybe more people would say, by gosh, that progressive budget, that sounds pretty good to me.
Well, maybe.
You know, yes, please. Can I weigh in for
a
second?
Yes, please. Yeah.
So, you know, one of the other issues beyond the fact that Republicans control the House and Democrats control the White House is the fact that the White House has been in the hands of one person for the last 5 years. I'm going to tell you what, come 2015, when Democrats start to have their own versions of CPAC, mm-hmm. which will be at Democratic gatherings.
Looking beyond the Obama
looking
years.
Beyond 2016, mm-hmm. right? Who's positioning themselves to be the next Democratic nominee? We're going to hear a lot about Democratic views that span the spectrum. We're going to hear from very, very liberal Democrats. We're going to hear from conservative Democrats. And there's going to be a lot of time spent on who this party is. Right now, it's not a story because the party is Barack Obama. Come 2015, he is not going to define the party anymore. And believe me, we're going to be covering that a great deal. And we will see all of those different pieces emerge. And we'll be talking about friction in the Democratic Party instead of just looking at the friction on the Republican side.
Interesting. In the week of CPAC, CPAC gets attention. Well, tune in 2015. We'll see what happens then. Gustavo wants to hear about it now. And that is interesting as well. People looking for the full debate as things seem kind of stalled out in Washington. More from this week, elation in Argentina when Argentina's own Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio now is named Pope Francis out of Latin America at this Metropolitan Cathedral in Buenos Aires. This woman cried out, Argentina, stand up and walk. Today, Argentina has gotten up. Glory be to God.
Argentina, levántate y anda. Y hoy Argentina se levantó. Gloria a ti, Señor Jesús.
There's excitement. The Steubenville rape case goes to trial. Big football players charged. Former Steubenville high school student Jane Crosby told the Associated Press the case has sharply divided her town.
Football is an important thing of this town. Yes, it's a huge economic thing, but I think that you don't get off the hook because you're an athlete.
And a dream goes viral. Vanderbilt student and pianist talked to Michael Pollack, talked his way on stage with Billy Joel. A skeptical Joel sang, the kid hit the keys, and wowed, it's all over YouTube.
I'm in a New York. Stay up. My.
There's a little tryout that worked out just great. We're looking at a week in the news. Pope Francis, budget dance, a gun bill moves, no big gulp ban, no knives on the plane. Well, maybe they'll be back. Gun bill. Amy Walter, where does this stand? It's moved out of committee in the Senate. What is before the Senate? What are its chances?
Well, it has moved out of the committee. This was on the banning certain assault weapons. But not surprisingly, it made it out of the committee on a purely party line vote. And so we see that the lines are once again drawn by party. Although I think when you talk about its future, it's less about where Republicans stand and much more about where some Democrats, especially those who are in red states, rural states, especially those who are up for re-election in 2014, what they're going to do about this. Senators from places like Arkansas, Alaska, Louisiana, who probably are not particularly excited about the prospect of voting for an assault weapons ban. I think that that is likely to ensure that it does not pass on the floor of the Senate, doesn't get enough votes, maybe even to get to the floor. But what seems to be a consensus view right now is the same view that has been out there for some time now, which is any kind of compromise on a gun issue is really have to be narrowly tailored. It's going to be talking about or focused on issues like background checks and maybe some mental health issues. But once you get beyond that, once you get into talking about ammunition, the number of bullets, the kinds of clips, the kinds of guns that you can use, that's when you start to lose a lot of Republicans. And as I said, you even start to lose many of the Democrats from those red states who are going to face the voters in a year and do not want to give Republicans, no pun intended, ammunition.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, what about what is actually in the bill that's moved out here now of the Senate committee when it comes to universal background check, assault weapons ban, cap on the number of rounds in a magazine? Are those things there now, or they didn't even make it out of committee?
Well, there are lots of different conversations that are going on, and I completely agree with Amy's assessment. You've got someone like Mark Pryor of Arkansas, who's very clearly saying he would not support an assault weapons ban. You have a Democrat like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who was just reelected, but is one of those people who is trying to find some consensus. So part of what we're talking about is cobbling together some different ideas. There's a bipartisan group that has a very narrow piece that they think they can get through, and that is dealing with if someone has been adjudicated mentally ill or any of those categories where an official court ruling has taken place, that there needs to be a better way of reporting that so that when background checks do take place, that gets flagged. When you talk about background checks, you do get a lot more signs from both certainly Democrats, but some Republicans that there could be a lane there. But I'm also hearing from Democrats who say that gun owners in their various states who believe in this right very carefully and very thoroughly and have lived with it, you know, the regional differences we often see, that they get frustrated if they believe law-abiding citizens would be in some way infringed upon. So this is a really hard issue for people. So the assault weapons ban is something that means a great deal to Dianne Feinstein, who has taken this from her own life experience many years ago as the mayor of San Francisco, and someone who has carried this for her party and for those who are concerned about this issue for a long time. She used considerable sway to get this even into the bill. And now it'll really go to Harry Reid, who himself has a very strong NRA rating, Democrat of Nevada, of course, the majority leader, to try to determine what can go to the floor. And will it be an open amendment process? Will it be lots of debate? Will there be chances for people to put bits and pieces together? A big sweeping package seems completely unable to move forward, but could they get pieces? And that's where I think people are focused. The other big question I hear all the time is, if they do something, will it be effective? Will it make any kind of real difference? Or is doing something for something's sake going to satisfy people? And I think they're really grappling with that, because people know that this matters in the country now. The events of 3 months ago in Sandy Hook, on top of every other tragic circumstance, has put this in the kind of glare of public emotion and certainly debate that we haven't seen in a long time. So I know that many members believe there is a moment here to try to do something, but they do seem to ask themselves, what would make a difference? And they're not really sure what that would be.
A new moment, but some old calculus at the same time. Jack, I'll come to you. Let me get Leslie in Magnolia, Delaware. Leslie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Todd, how are you?
Well, what do you think?
I really do think that background checks are important. Considering what just happened in Sandy Brook, and we had a number of these tragic situations happen in the United States, background checks are important. We need to understand whether people have the responsibility and have the confidence of being able to hold a weapon. And not only that, with all of the preparing of these people who went out and they did these terroristic acts. You know, they accumulated these weapons. They wrote down their plans in a journal. To me, that's premeditated.
Sure. So let's have background check universal, you say, and we've got it, Leslie. I appreciate your call. Here was the Texas Senator John Cornyn, Republican, yesterday at the Senate Judiciary's hearings vote on the assault weapons ban, saying, well, I mean, at one point he said, you know, we're going to leave Americans with nothing but pea shooters to defend themselves with. And he said, you don't need universal background checks. Here's Cornyn.
We simply need to patch the holes in the background check system that enable the mentally ill to buy guns. That's the type of legislation I think would have the greatest positive impact on gun violence in America. But instead, we're considering a piece of legislation that jeopardizes the self-defense rights of law-abiding citizens while doing nothing to address the real problems.
Jack Beatty, there's Leslie in Delaware, says, come on, let's have universal background checks. Looks around, it's like terrorist acts in our own country. There's a senator from Texas saying, you're threatening the self-defense potential of American citizens.
Yes, Leslie is on the public opinion is on her side. Poll from the Washington Post on Monday: 91% of the public wants universal background check. Yet all eight members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Republicans, voted against it. That underlies that cultural gap that Kelly was talking about. That if you're from a red state and a really red district in the House, it doesn't matter what the national opinion is. You've got to look at your own opinion on the local. And you had Chuck Grassley, who's thought to be the more moderate senator there, talking about, oh, he was afraid that if you started with universal background checks, you'd have a gun registry. There's a federal law against that. Nevertheless, he said that would go that way. And then, quote, gun confiscation. Well, that's, of course, right out of the paranoid, some call it that, playbook of the NRA. And you know, and then everyone saying the assault weapons ban, the clips, that no chance of that. And yet, you know, the Hartford Courant came out with a big piece, I think, just the other day, pointing out that the killer at Sandy Hook shot 152 bullets in 5 minutes. He used 430 bullet clips. If the assault weapon ban had been in place, the one that... Or the clip cap, yeah. Mm-hmm. He would have had to reload 14 times instead of 4 times.
14 now, chances to intervene.
14 chances to intervene. 14, a delay in allowing the police to get there. There it is. I mean, it looks like we may have to wait, and this is a terrible thing to say, but almost certainly some other massacre is going to happen.
And how big, how bad can they get? Here was California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein yesterday in the same Senate Judiciary Committee. Here she is.
Are we going to stand with the victims of gun violence? Are we going to stand with the overwhelming number of people? There has not been one poll done that doesn't show that a majority of Americans want this bill passed. How is this country going to be a weaker country because we don't produce millions of assault weapons?
I'm left thinking about these polls and whether or not, Amy, they translate into policy. Or is this just so district by district? And back to the map we were talking about, of electoral districts, that even if polls overwhelmingly suggest support for this or that measure, it doesn't, won't happen because it's not the way it breaks down district-wise?
I think that's part of it. And I think the other part of it is when we ask questions in polls, it's without any context around it, right? So just if I asked you, do you love puppies and kittens and sunshine? Of course you say yes. And then I say, well, what if I told you something about these puppies, right? Like, well, it also happens that this puppy is going to chew all of your socks all the time. Would you still want this puppy? Would you still want it to be sunny all the time? Right. So the thing about the background checks, it's true. You ask people, do you think we should have background checks? Of course. We don't want crazy people or criminals, bad people having guns. But then to Kelly's point, it is, but what is this really going to do? There was a point at which back in 1994 when they passed the assault weapons ban, I think it was something like 70% of Americans believed that doing this was going to prevent the next massacre. Of course, it wasn't long after that that Columbine happened. And now we've had, it seems every 2 or 3 months, horrific things happen that we say, well, this will be the issue. This will be the issue that's going to galvanize Americans around stronger gun control. Instead, what it seemed to do, and the last poll showed, most recent polling showed this, is actually move people away from this idea that gun control is going to make a difference. Now, I think it's something like 55% saying they thought that gun control or assault weapons ban was going to have an impact on reducing these sorts of this sort of violence or these random acts like we've seen at Sandy Hook and in Aurora, Colorado. So there seems, sadly, to be a kind of numbness around this. And I think for a lot of people, and this is where we get beyond the policy and get into the cultural piece of this, which is there are a lot of people in this country who own guns who feel as if they are being spoken down to, that they are not the people doing these crimes. They are the ones who are law-abiding citizens. They're following the rules. No one they know would ever do something like this. And they feel like they're being punished for the sins of a couple, or this handful of people who in many cases are mentally ill. So, you know, it feels like, and this is where Joe Manchin, as Kelly O'Donnell pointed out, Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, tried to bridge that cultural gap. He knew that you needed somebody from a state like West Virginia to go in and say, listen, I understand you. I come from you. I'm not from New York. I'm not from Washington. I'm not from an urban area. I am from a rural area, and I think we need to have more sensible gun laws. But even he was not particularly successful at that. So that's going to be the bigger challenge.
And yet,
it's about expectations and incentives, people's expectations. If there are new policies, would they in fact work? Would they feel like they could be something you could count on? And incentives. Politically right now, there are very few incentives for lawmakers to take some of these steps. So if people really want those polls to translate into policy, they have to create the sort of electoral incentives to make lawmakers move on this issue. And that's where we still have a ways to go.
All those dead children in Newtown on our minds as we look at this debate. So much attention this week to the selection of a new pope, Pope Francis, the first in over 1,200 years from outside Europe, the first from Latin America, the first Jesuit, and the first to assume the name Francis. Here he was speaking to the crowds gathered at the Vatican Wednesday night after he was revealed as the new pope. Interpreted here by CNN.
Brothers and sisters, good evening. As you know, the duty of the conclave is to give Rome a bishop. It seems that my brother cardinals went almost to the end of the world, but we are here.
But we are here. Kelly O'Donnell, so much attention to this. Here's maybe another media moment to ask about. Is 1.2 billion Catholics, that's a lot around the world. And people really hanging on this at the same time. A lot of people who aren't Catholics maybe don't care. Do you think we had the right amount of coverage of the papal decision?
Well, I think it was interesting because of all those historical elements you just mentioned. But it was also a media event in the sense that you had a visual to watch, whether it was the white smoke or the crowds in the square. You had an unknown outcome, who would be chosen. That created a certain drama. Then you have all of the controversy that the church has endured and will continue to, and all of the emotion that people put into their faith. And so I think there were a lot of legitimate reasons why it was covered so much. I think a lot of the discussion about an American becoming pope was sort of for our own entertainment. There's just no way we could know what was in the mind of the conclave. And now to hear that we have a new pope and he has a somewhat different personal style That is a new story unto itself. I'm sort of surprised there has never been a Francis before with that name so identifiable in the church. So I have been asked by people why so much coverage. As a Catholic, I will say I was glued to it. But I do understand that criticism. But I think when you look at sort of the elements of what can drive a media story, they were all there, including something as spectacular as the Vatican setting itself. It is a city-state, so there's a diplomatic aspect to it as well, a religious aspect. You put all those layers together, and it was quite compelling.
And Jack, certainly the center of gravity of the Catholic population today in Latin America. Many Latin Americans very moved to see someone from their continent after so many centuries to be the Pope.
Yes, and he said to, quote, have a heart for the poor. And his lifestyle, lives in an apartment, drives the bus, and in Rome paid his own bill and carried his own luggage. On the other hand, back in Buenos Aires, human rights campaigners wonder at his, did he cooperate too much with the regime during the dirty war, and then gay rights people saying, you know, does this portend more radicalization of the Vatican's position against recognizing diverse families? So, mixed picture.
Well, the spectacle and suspense are past. We'll see what happens in the years ahead. Jack, thanks very much for being with us. Amy Walter with the Cook Political Report. Thank you so much, Amy.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot.
And Kelly O'Donnell with NBC News. Thank you, Kelly.
Always so much fun. Thank you.
This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.